What would be, well, my question is this. Now, I've heard a lot of rhetoric. What would be the solution to this? I mean,
well, that's my point, Daddy. Is it morally right? This is for everybody. Is it morally correct to take people's things? Is it morally correct to use violence against people? Is it? Because once you answer me, then I'm going to tell you my point.
I believe that you should protect yours, whatever it is.
But my answer family, the question, please. Family. Is it wrong to hit people, and is it wrong to take other people's things?
Oh, no. It is wrong. It is wrong. But it also. But let me add something to that. When it comes to protecting yours, you should do whatever you have to do to protect it.
Right, but I'm not talking. But I agree, that's self-defense. But there is no self-defense if there's no aggression towards someone. Do you agree?
Yes, but add to it again, because okay, we're talking, all right. Yes, if you're right, if it's no aggression to you, you shouldn't be aggressive. But if there's some exhibit on you, you should do it. But let me get back to the word you used earlier, structure. Okay, I look at my family as having structure. Okay, and I realize that in order to have structure, you have a family, you have to have structure. I looked at the government as being a structure. We talked about that as well. So my point is this. How would your family be if you had not had structure?
That's not the question. You're trying to talk about a different point. We're not talking about where the structure come from. We can if you want.
I mean,
unless you're saying that government creates the family structure. Is that what you're saying?
I'm saying the government creates a structure whereby.
But who created the idea of government?
Our forefathers.
People, thank you. People. But who were the forefathers? Were they people?
Yeah, but
they were people, correct? Mm-hmm. So that means if people created the government, then people created structure. Since you said government was a structure, so therefore we don't need the government because people already created the idea of structure.
But they're on the
same
level.
So why do we need government then?
we need more people like you, Rodney, to get involved with the government.
Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to the podcast. Today is the 19th, and what you've heard so far is a clip from a new podcast hosted by a gentleman out in Chicago named Rodney Smith, and the show is called The Freedom Experiment. And he's only done a handful of episodes so far, but a lot of the material that he's released is him discussing the ideas of liberty with friends, family, and people in his community. And I think there's been a lot of talk for a long time about the lack of diversity in, for lack of a better description, the liberty movement. And Rodney asked me, you know, he said, I'm really trying to figure out why African Americans are so unfamiliar with these ideas. And he also wanted to discuss the concept of collectivism. That was kind of our starting point. I mean, I recorded our whole conversation, so I'm going to share pretty much the whole conversation with you today, but that was one of the things we wanted to talk about. We also talked about nonviolent communication, parenting, the Great Society, and trapping generations of people in a permanent underclass. And towards the end of the show, we actually wound up talking about sports, or as they say out in Chicago, sparts. They don't all talk like that. Rodney was a college athlete. And he actually went to Purdue University. And once we got into that part of the conversation, Rodney was able to provide some perspective, obviously, that I lack. He was recruited, you know, to this D1 school, and he mentions that, you know, he was lucky to have a father. He actually heard in that clip that I played from his show, one of the people in that conversation is his father. But that's not the case for a lot of people who are coming out of the inner city. Many who are getting recruited play college basketball or college football. And this is something, I think an insight that I had before our discussion is that often in these situations, the coaches develop this sort of larger than life male role model, male authority figure persona in the lives of these kids. And I think there's a lot of unhealthy stuff that goes on in college athletics if you haven't been checking the news for the last 6 months. I mean, Rodney's not talking about anything like that, but because of that power disparity that exists in that relationship, he does mention that sometimes these relationships did feel, and really in all actuality, become verbally abusive. In the case of Bobby Knight in Indiana, physically abusive. And, you know, Rodney went to Purdue. I happened across this clip of Bobby Knight giving his team a motivational speech at halftime. And during this game, Indiana was actually playing Purdue. And it sounds like from the tone of this conversation that Rodney's team is winning. And from the very least, just judging by the YouTube comments, it seems like this interaction, it's not even an interaction, this quote-unquote motivational speech from Bobby Knight to the Indiana players is totally acceptable. It's even, oh, some people might even say admirable, because what he's trying to do is motivate them, right? But you can answer this question for yourself. I'll ask it. When you listen to this clip, what does it sound like is really important here to Bobby Knight? Is it his players, the morale of the team, or is it something else?
Want to play, then I'm getting the out of here. I mean, if you're not going to recover Greg Graham, if you're just going to let him drive by you, if the rest of you are going to let him catch the ball outside the 3-second lane and drive all the way in here without one guy challenging him, then I'm leaving and you guys will run till you can't even suffer. Now, hey, I'm tired of this shit. I'm sick and tired of an 8-10 record. I'm tired of losing to Purdue. I'm not here to around this week. Now, you may be, but I'm not. Now, I'm going to guarantee you that if we don't play up there Monday night, you aren't going to believe the next 4 days. Now, I am not here to get my ass beat on Monday. Now, you better understand that right now. This is absolute bullshit. Now, I'll run your ass right into the ground. I mean, I'll run you. You'll think last night was a picnic. I had to sit around for a year with an 8-10 record in this league. And I mean, you will not put me in that position again, or you will goddamn pay for it like you can't believe.
And some of the comments for this were like, yeah, Bobby Knight is awesome. Yeah, that great speech. Searching for this guy on YouTube will get you, you know, Bobby Knight throws a chair, Bobby Knight chokes a player, Bobby Knight loses it on a reporter. And this is all just kind of like fodder. And most of us aren't paying attention to, you know, college sports. But here's a whole other area. And, you know, when Rodney talks about how his relationship with his college coach ended, his college coach was Bobby Knight's main rival. It really made me think about how the consequences of this acceptance of abuse, the consequences of the acceptance of this power disparity, and the consequences of the surrender of individual identity for the sake of a group, which really just means for the sake of the so-called leader or ruler of that group, is just so all over the place and goes unnoticed in so many places. So here's the show. I hope you enjoy this. It's definitely something different. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I look forward to talking to Rodney again in the future. Thanks for listening. Take care.
I really wanted to discuss assumed authority figures and collectivism, especially how it affects African Americans, because I know a lot of people that I know are not privy to that type of information. So I just wanted to bring it up so they could, you know, get used to those terms.
Yeah, and I'm a novice on that aspect of it, and I'm really curious as to why there isn't greater diversity within the liberty movement, period.
Yeah, me too. But I understand why, and that's why I wanted to do the podcast, because whenever, because to me, collectivism is so big in the African-American community. Whenever somebody says something against a mainstream leader in the African-American community, they're considered some kind of Uncle Tom or something.
Yeah.
And I think that's ludicrous. And I think the more we separate ourselves from liberty-minded people, then the worse off we're going to be.
I'm interested to learn more really about your experience too. Like, yeah. have you tried to approach these topics with people?
Yes. Everybody I've approached it with have never heard of it, except one. My cousin, I think he has a bachelor's in economics from NYU, some college in New York, but he still is fairly unfamiliar with like Milton Friedman or Thomas Sowell or Hayek or any of the Austrian economists or the libertarian movement.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still fairly new to people.
Yeah, there was also a lot of demagoguing of it, too, with Ron Paul trying to connect it to racism.
Yes, I agree.
So, and if you're not for, you know, social programs, people would also try to walk that over to racism as well. I mean, it's a slippery slope kind of argument. It's a very weak argument, but it, from what I see in the mainstream media, there's a lot of really weak arguments that pass as strong ones. So
I've been interviewing people, and it's on my podcast, and they make those same arguments you're making. Like one lady, she's on government assistance that, you know, helps out her family and stuff. So she really doesn't understand what I'm talking about when I try to explain to her, you know, how harmful the government is with these programs.
A friend of mine lives in Oklahoma, and he was talking about through a church he was affiliated with in the past, they would go to the inner city to do, you know, like work with the community as charity. And the idea for some of these people, and this isn't even a race thing, because, you know, I spent a lot of time in Vermont, which is extremely white, and there's a lot of people living on government assistance there as well. But people just, generation after generation, they can't even imagine another way that things could possibly be. It's like they don't even see that there's an alternative to the welfare state and them being a part of it.
I agree, and that's why I really want to do it, because people don't believe there's an alternative. Because I've been a school teacher, too, and in the books, you know, it just presents the current system as the best thing and the only thing. And that's what people grow up learning. Even me. I mean, I was the biggest statist ever.
Yeah.
So I totally can see how people don't realize there's another alternative.
Yeah, you know, we were in the last episode of my show, we were talking about the 1960s and how there was there's these conspiracies about the Apollo missions that they were faked for one reason or another. And we were talking about the need to diffuse some of the social tensions in the country, like just to establish, to ask ourselves the question. I don't have a dog in that fight one way or the other. Like, I really don't care. It's an exciting story if that was some kind of a hoax, but it really doesn't matter to me in the big picture. But we were examining the plausibility of it, and we were talking about the social tensions in the United States in the 1960s and how, you know, a lot of inner city areas were really just exploding, where people had enough of the status quo. And with, you know, the death of Dr. King and the death of RFK, it was really a situation that needed to be pacified, you know, especially after the riots in California in the late 60s. That was even before, I think, King and Kennedy were assassinated. And it seems like the Great Society programs of Lyndon Johnson arrived just in time to buy out, or to buy off, rather, an entire group of people, to pacify them and say, you know, now you need us. And right. To take the people who were the most desperate and the most likely to, you know, start some kind of a meaningful insurrection, more than had already been changed through the civil rights movement in the 1960s, I think there was a lot at stake. And it seems like an entire group of people was just bought off by the government and trapped in the inner cities. You have people who just became trapped in a permanent lower class.
Right. I totally agree with you. And that's why I think black people love Clinton, too, because didn't he introduce a lot of more social programs, social welfare programs as well?
Clinton played it more down the middle and actually wound up reforming the welfare program. And I think it was during the Clinton administration where the idea of welfare to work was introduced, that people need to, mm-hmm. there needs to be, which I, if I was somebody who was forward thinking, but had either grown up on government assistance or was still on government assistance, the idea of whether Clinton was sincere about it or not, I really don't know. And even if the program was ever effectively implemented, I would say the numbers would demonstrate the opposite. But the idea, introducing the idea to people again, people who had, for so long been disenfranchised, been left out of the political right. process in any meaningful way, to say, look, this is a society where there is upward mobility, right? So it shouldn't be. I forget who said it, but it said it shouldn't be comfortable to be poor.
Right.
Ben Franklin. It was actually Ben Franklin who said that poverty shouldn't be comfortable. And it doesn't mean that people should suffer in poverty. And when I talk about, phasing out the state, I think that a lot of conservatives, because politics has all that animosity built into it, they want to go after the most desperate people first, like the people who have the least chance to fight back, the people who have the least chance to stand up for themselves. And then when you can associate libertarianism through the Ron Paul or the Rand Paul with conservatism, yeah, it looks cruel and heartless and racist. And, that's an easy thing to tack onto it, even though it's really not true. I mean, the welfare that I would go after first would be like General Electric, Boeing, if it was not just going to be a total sudden collapse of the state, if it was something that people could say, all right, we need a 50-year plan. This is kind of fanciful thinking, but we need a 50-year plan to phase this out. What do we get rid of first? I don't think that I understand today that people survive because these programs exist, because a culture of dependence has been built. And right. I don't think that those people, whether they're senior citizens or inner city poor or disabled or whoever benefits from these government programs, I don't think that they should be punished. And that's really becoming a narrative in popular culture or in the mainstream media right now with conservative voices, is that society has been taken over by people who are not white and want stuff for free. And I think that this is an incredibly dangerous and ominous way of talking, and really even more than I was already thinking about comparisons between the United States of today and the Germany of the 1930s. Like, I don't like the direction that dialogue is going in at all. But with the re-election of Barack Obama, it's like America has been taken over by minorities who want stuff for free. And that's a real conversation that it's subtle, but it's there. And that's scary.
Yeah, it is. And it's real. Like the girl I was talking to you about before, that was her exact comment. She said she doesn't have a problem with getting stuff for free and taking money from rich people.
Right. So we demonize this certain group of rich people, and they're demonizing poor people. But the government is, basically funneling money up from people who are in the middle to the people who are most connected and most powerful, and sprinkling just enough down to prevent an insurrection from right. the people who have nothing to lose. And it's the people in the middle, and I mean in the middle, from people who make like $20,000 a year to maybe, I don't know, $1 million a year. I'm picking those numbers kind of arbitrarily, but they're the ones who are paying, and everybody wants to participate and get all upset about these divisions that really don't apply to them, right? So they're arguing with the makers and the takers, and they're really just being, they're all part of the group that's being fleeced, and they're arguing with each other about, who should be fleeced. And meanwhile, the people who are the most desperate are the ones that I think, even though they might not be paying to support all of this, they're being hurt the most because they're being trapped in this desperate situation, what should be a desperate situation that has now just been covered with enough comfort to make it tolerable, so it continues generation after generation.
Yeah, I totally agree with you, Brett.
So what other kinds of conversations have you had about what other kind of pushback have you got from the people that you've talked to?
Same thing that you're saying, like, what will happen? They think that when I make these arguments, they think that I'm saying that all poor people should just suffer in poverty, and that I believe that the rich people are just going to take over the world once the government does disappear, and poverty will be even worse. That seems to be the general argument and pushback that I get.
I wonder how they would describe the world in which we currently live.
Right. And that's why I do the podcast, because, and I even admit it myself, is that I didn't, before Barack Obama came up for election, I had never voted before. I had never studied politics. And the same people that I interview are in the same boat. And I tell them on the podcast, I was like, I even voted just because Barack was black. I knew nothing about politics.
Yeah.
And I know they're in the same boat, and they don't want to admit it or even analyze the current system or any alternative. So I can understand where they're coming from.
And what was it? I mean, what did you tell yourself? I'm interested, because obviously I have a limited understanding of what this would be like. When Barack Obama shows up, it really is just as simple as, I'm going to vote for him because he's black?
Yes. And everybody around me was the same way, because before I knew anything about anarchy, libertarian movement, or even how the government works, I thought I was a victim because I was African American, because I had, up until that point, I had a master's degree before Barack Obama was elected, but it was hard to find a job. And my excuse was the excuse most of the black people around me used, was that it had to be racism or discrimination. Because, I mean, I had experienced it growing up, how a lot of white people would talk to me, how people viewed me or treated me because I was black, even in sports. I played ball. A lot of my coaches were big racist, mm-hmm. and would even say racist things. So the only thing I could come up with, it had to be racism. So if a black man was going to be elected, it seemed like the most rational and logical thing to do was to help elect him. And that would solve all my problems.
Did you envision it any further? Like what you thought Obama would do once he became president?
No, I didn't even really know how it worked. I didn't know about an electoral college. I mean, when growing up in school, they didn't teach me about that. I'm really electing an electoral college person to select the president. And then once he's elected, citizens really don't have no say so in, you know, how bills and laws are created.
And it's not like you couldn't have done that bad in school if you went to Purdue, right? I mean, you must have had decent grades. So, yeah, our understanding of how the process actually works, they could never explain it to us in school, because it would be so disheartening. It's like, what would be the point of participating? And I think that obviously, teachers and college professors, from my experience, want young people to vote, because typically when people are young, they are Democrats.
Yeah.
So voting, all of these campaigns of like Rock the Vote and Vote or Die and whatever else came out of Hollywood in the last 15 years, that it's not just saying vote. It's like, vote for our guys. Like Will Ferrell from Saturday Night Live made this video, Things I'll Do for You If You Vote. Now, all he ever says is, if you vote, but clearly he's talking about voting for Obama, because it's a message that's attractive to young people. So I remember being in college, and the liberal, very, very liberal college professor that I always talk about, standing in one of the entranceways to one of the school buildings, and he was just signing people up to vote. And it wasn't like, you know, vote for so and so, but it's assumed that young people will vote for Democrats, and that certainly serves the interests of the liberal college professors and the unionized public sector teachers. So they really, even if they have started to understand that, like, yeah, there's a lot more to this process that would really be discouraging to young people if they understand it, that should all be omitted, and we should talk about these far-fetched, warm and fuzzy things that could happen if Barack Obama or whoever becomes president. And I've said this several times on my show recently, that I was excited when Obama became president because, yes, it was neat to be alive when somebody gets elected president who also didn't meet the criteria to be in the Ku Klux Klan. Like, that was as somebody who was a student of history and a lover of history, that was a momentous thing for sure. And
so is this recording now? Are you recording?
Yeah, I figured we could just do it, you know.
Cool.
We already got like 15 minutes of good stuff. So
okay, good. And I want to. So then, since we record, I want to talk about. Can you talk about your thoughts on collectivism and assumed authority figures and the destructiveness of blind obedience to assumed authority figures and the use of collectivism?
Yeah, I think that collectivism is certainly an idea that we've seen the consequences of in the last couple centuries. And what the general idea is that the individual should sacrifice for the needs of the group. And, you know, that sounds very warm and thoughtful and altruistic, but the consequence of that is that the needs of the state or the needs of the authority are often pushed out in front as the needs of the group. And the public mind is something that has been shown through a variety of methods to be very malleable. So the needs of the very few can very easily, through propaganda and other means, be turned into the seemingly the desire of the majority, to which the individual must sacrifice his or her own needs, own volition, to, you know, be a good citizen or for the greater good, or to not be seen as, like, how is Ayn Rand in mainstream thought is often a synonym for the embrace of thoughtless selfishness or living at the expense of others, which is basically one of the things that she railed against most vehemently, was living at the expense of others and divided people into the productive class versus the parasitic or the predatory class. And I think there was her work on the topic of individualism versus collectivism is animated by a lot of emotion from her own experience. She was growing up during the Russian Revolution, and we all know how that turned out. You know, she really went as far as she could to warn people about the dangers of collectivistic thinking. But we live in a very collectivistic culture today, where people talk about the common good and the greater good, because that's what they've been prepared through schooling to understand and to accept.
Right. That's why I wanted you to talk about it, because to me, since a group is just an abstraction, the only way for the group to have this common good or common thought is for the assumed leader or authority figure within that group to come up with the goal. Therefore, it's still only the goal of those few people, and it can't be the goal of the whole group. And to me, that's what I see a lot in the African-American community as well as other communities, because especially in reference to government and anarchy, because the collectivistic thought of anarchy is always chaos, even though people have never taken the time to define anarchy or look at the etymology of anarchy. Everybody seems to have the same collective thought on anarchy. And back to the African-American community, many people believe that, like you were saying, if you're African-American and you're going to vote Republican, then something's wrong with you, because the collective thought is that you must support the Democratic Party, because it's assumed that the group has been protected by the Democratic Party since its inception. And I just think that's so wrong and incorrect. And people, it just shows that people haven't looked into it. And I'm one of them, because I remember not looking into it and believing these collectivistic thoughts about the African-American community and voting and rights and racism and discrimination.
Well, I hope that that idea helps to clarify then that I think a lot of African Americans should understand that they cannot trust the establishment, that they cannot and should not trust the power structure, regardless of what political party it calls itself right. at any given time. I think that there should be, just with history as our guide, a healthy suspicion. And they should understand, and anybody who thinks that they are going to benefit from government for these reasons that you've talked about in the long run, or that an entire group of people is going to benefit from the policies or the actions of government in the long run, needs to understand this idea that empowering the government, this is something that I say to liberals very frequently, empowers the people that you are most afraid of, that you have the most disdain for, because they are the people who will always have the money and therefore will always have the access to power. So they will tell you all kinds of stories about why the government needs to be bigger and why the government needs to be more powerful. But it really is just, if you are a ordinary peaceful person trying to, you know, make your way through this world like so many of us are, that is just handing a bigger weapon to your enemies. And I don't want to use all of this enemy imagery, but I think it's important to understand that for a long time, those in power have viewed ordinary people, you know, the unwashed masses, as an enemy that war needed to be waged against on multiple fronts. And the establishment of the welfare state was just one of those fronts. You know, that's more the Fabian strategy.
Right, that gradualistic, slow process. Right, mm-hmm. I agree. And that's why I think the elite and the ruling class love collectivism, because it's so easy to control the mainstream thoughts and ideas on certain topics.
And I think that's an important thing to point out there as well, that once somebody's in power, regardless of whatever their ideals were, regardless of whatever they said in speeches, or regardless of how many peace signs they put on their campaign posters, they serve the agenda that's already moving along. And I would challenge liberals and African Americans to point out to me what really changed when Barack Obama was inaugurated the President of the United States in 2009, aside from the fears and the anxiety of old white men on Fox News, like what really were the substantial changes in policy or culture? And one of the reasons why I was talking earlier about being excited about Obama's election is I was hoping that there would be this aha moment for people 4 years later when they saw that, wow, not really nothing substantial is different today. In fact, a lot of the same things that we really disliked about George Bush
yes.
are still continuing. Man. And that wake up just didn't happen. I think I've been kind of naive about there will be this aha moment where people will say, ah, yes, the people who spoke from the liberty viewpoint were right. They told us this would happen. But that moment for most people, I don't think it's coming. I think that whatever happens, they will just integrate into their belief system. And because politics is so adversarial, they can always just blame whatever party they're not a part of for these things. And talk about how whatever the developments that we would hopefully see as a wake up call, like the National Defense Authorization
That's
Act.
That's just what I was going to talk about. I agree with you.
They would say, ah, well, must be necessary.
Yes, I agree. And that just proves my point, Brett, that just like myself, many African Americans were just voting because he was black. We wasn't looking at, you know, the bills and the acts he was voting on and approving and not approving. And you can tell. You can definitely tell, can't you, Brett?
It's interesting, too, because if you look at Obama's history prior to running for president in 2008, it was almost like, I don't want to sound conspiratorial, but it was almost like he was being prepared for that job. The road was being paved for Obama in 2008. And if you look at his voting record when he was in the Senate for the brief period that he was, on a lot of controversial things, he is only voting present, meaning that he is not really establishing much of a voting record for himself, because I think the only a couple times in history were senators or congressmen able to be elected president, because the problem is when they promised the electorate a bunch of crap, you could go and get a very clear idea of what they would do based on the voting record that they had when they were in Congress or the Senate. So before Obama, the last person to come out of Congress and be president might have been Kennedy. So Obama is playing it like, it seems, real carefully during that time from about 2006 to 2008 that he's in the U.S. Senate, where he isn't really putting his cards on the table. So when he shows up as a candidate and he can do hope and change and something different and something exciting, that's enough. And most people aren't going to look any further into him than that.
Right, I agree. Yeah, I didn't even know that. So is that uncommon? You said that hasn't happened since Kennedy?
Usually the people who become president are former vice presidents or governors, because people like, executive experience.
Okay, that makes sense.
And I'm actually just going to, while we talk, I'll look that up. Yeah, so I understand that sentiment that after whatever people had observed from a minority viewpoint for decades in the United States, that seeing Obama come along must have been a very exciting thing.
It was. And I was in Atlanta during that time, so it was extremely big. And I was doing door-to-door sales at the time, and people were being dropped off. Like, while I'm going door-to-door, people are being dropped off in cars to go door to door and talk about the election for Barack Obama. So when I would go to a door, people would think I was some type of activist for Barack Obama. And I'm like, no, I'm just trying to sell you natural gas, lady. So I saw how big it was. And at the night he was going to be elected, I was out at a club, and it was just full of balloons and happy people talking about this black man is going to be elected. But just like the people I was with, none of them knew anything about politics or anything Barack had stood for or what he would do once he got in. So I totally agree with you that it just seemed like hope to us minorities.
Yeah. And just to clarify what I said a moment earlier, it's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 presidents came from Congress. So it's a lot higher than I thought.
Okay.
But the last one before Obama was Nixon, and Nixon had also been the vice president. So Johnson, Kennedy, Truman, and Harding were the other ones in the 20th century.
Okay.
That's out of 43, so... And it's something that has occurred with less frequency, the more access to information people have, if I may amend my statement a little bit. So having a very clear record of what you will do policy-wise when given the opportunity, it seemed like Obama was working to not leave that kind of a trail.
Right, okay.
But would give a speech... You know, that had where there's nothing at stake about how he disagreed with, you know, X, Y, and Z that Bush was doing.
But then he continues what Bush does once he gets in office.
Yeah, and I was hoping that would be an important wake up call and realization for a lot of liberals, but it just wasn't.
Yeah, I agree, it wasn't.
And I think that's part of it too. I think that. The more I converse with people about these topics, the more I realize that this was not about exchanging information to come to, a reasoned-based conclusion. It was about trying to escape the conversation with the belief system that people are comfortable with still intact.
Right.
So I think that before we engage people, one of the questions that should be examined, you know, first of all, as we, the people who are trying to share the philosophy of liberty with them, is what I'm trying to do here even possible, or am I just, you know, setting myself up to be frustrated? What is at stake for them emotionally to come to believe that what I'm saying is true? And that might be a question that's even worth leading the conversation with. Like, what are the implications for you if what you believe is wrong? If that's not even a question that they're willing to contemplate, it might not be worth your time and energy and serenity to go forward with that conversation.
Right.
And when you talk about these people who are living on government support, the emotional stakes might just be too high.
Yeah, and I agree. And I did. I told her I don't think that somebody should have that type of benefit just snatched away, and that I want to see you suffer without these benefits. I'm just saying that I believe that if these things were gone, it would be more opportunities for you to experience economic upward mobility without the government support.
Now, how could you give somebody examples for that? Like, what if they said, well, tell me more about that? Because I think because we are the fish in this water of statism, it's hard for people to imagine an alternative world. So has anyone ever asked you for specific examples of how their life could be better if they weren't, you know, being held down by these programs that trap people in permanent poverty?
Yes, but nothing I say seems to work, because I know they haven't tried to research it for themselves or have an idea of what I'm talking about. So the best example that I try to use is I say that, you know, the government is funded through taxation, which comes from taking money from working people, which also, you know, they take money from businesses, too, through business taxes. So I was like, well, what if people could keep the money that the government takes from us,
mm-hmm.
and then they would have more opportunities to do what they want with their own money.
Sure. And I mean, just one example that always comes to mind for me when we're talking about policies that people who tend to vote Democrat are typically in favor of is more regulation and restriction and taxes for corporations. You know, so they say, yes, let's tax these corporations and then we'll use that money for some social program. And it sounds wonderful. Oh, it sounds great. Right. Like if you strip out any kind of principle from the conversation.
Right.
That sounds, from a very pragmatic standpoint, yes, let's tax these super wealthy corporations, like, you know, who are the ones that are always trotted out in front of all the small businesses that will eventually suffer from these policies. Well, ExxonMobil,
yeah,
Walmart, Halliburton. Right. So we'll punish them, those greedy bastards, and then we'll turn that money into programs of social uplift. Well, you know, it's not like when corporate taxes go up that there's a board meeting at Halliburton where they say, okay, Bob, you know, you're going to have to sell that yacht, and, you know, you're going to have to get the $4,000 curtains instead of the $8,000 curtains for your office. No, all of those costs are transferred to consumers.
Right.
So it's not like, oh, geez, we have to pay more taxes now. It's like, oh, too bad for the consumers. They have to pay higher prices now. So, you know, who shops at Walmart?
Right. Who? Regular, normal people, not those big executives. And that's the example I use, Brett. I tried to explain to her that will cause inflation. And her, not just her, but other people, they say, well, why don't they just print more money? They should just print. I was like, well, that will just cause hyperinflation. But nobody knows what inflation is or what causes it or what it is. So it's hard to talk to them.
I think the easiest way to explain it, well, what is inflation? Why is this important? All important question, how will this affect me? Well, when the government prints more, and I shouldn't even say the government, when the Federal Reserve prints more money and puts it into circulation, before it ripples out to everybody else who is not connected to government, the people that the money was printed for, banks and corporations and defense contractors and whatever, when this money is created electronically, they get to use it first when it has the high higher value. And then as it ripples out to the rest of the economy, it becomes more valueless because there's more of it. So you could equate it to a supply and demand argument, where if there is more of something, it is less valuable.
Yeah.
So people also need to understand maybe just a very, very quick history that you probably remember a time in your life. You could say this to whoever you're talking to, and the older they are, I guess, the better, when this cost X dollars and now it costs Y dollars, which is usually, well, or X times two or X times $3. So they can see that prices have changed while their standard of living hasn't improved commensurate with that. So the other part of that, I feel like there's one more part of that. You could talk about dollars versus assets. Like before the establishment of the Federal Reserve, let's just say, and I'm picking numbers somewhat arbitrarily, an ounce of gold could buy 200 loaves of bread. Today, an ounce of gold can buy 200 loaves of bread. But in Federal Reserve notes, before the Federal Reserve was established, let's say in the early 19-teens, a loaf of bread was 5 cents. Today, a loaf of bread is $3. So it's not that goods have become more expensive, because like the process for growing grain is easier. The process for packaging and preserving and everything on the production side of a product is easier than it was in 1910.
Because they improved technology.
Right. But the cost is 60 times more. Right. So why? You know, I think these are simple arguments that don't have a lot of detail. And I think one of the problems with trying to explain some of this stuff to, you know, people who've never been introduced to these ideas from an economics angle is that enthusiastic leaders can sometimes get way too far ahead of their followers. And they wind up getting frustrated because they're making what to them and their experience seems like a simple argument, but it's just so foreign to somebody else, it's not really resonating with them in a way that's meaningful.
Right.
So I try to keep things as simple as possible just by asking that question, how would I explain this to my 16-year-old self? And that's what I try to do on my show. But I think that there's a lot of very simple arguments that aren't weighed down with a lot of jargon and gobbledygook about economics that can resonate with people, because that's a very important question for people. How is this going to affect me with my standard of living, my security, so on and so forth?
And that's the problem I face too, Brett. Like, how can I make this make sense to this other person, you know, without me trying to seem condescending to them?
Yeah. Oh, trust me. It's something that I've worked on for years, because you get frustrated.
Yeah.
And one of the things that I retreat to kind of irresponsibly out of frustration and emotion, this is, you know, a mistake that I've made several times in the past, is I'll say, oh, well, you know, you're just indoctrinated. This is just too emotional for you. You're not thinking clearly because, you know, you're clouded with emotion and you've been indoctrinated and you're a consumer of the mainstream media. So we're not even having a conversation, you know, and that lack of empathy and understanding and, you know, trying to shame somebody into understanding why they are wrong never really works. And I think that a more nonviolent communication approach is ultimately what is going to work with people in the long run and long term. And I think that's what we're describing a little bit, is like, what are your concerns and what are your needs?
Right.
Yeah. And even if we're talking about material things or the need for comfort or the need for security, and the larger need for understanding, being able to clarify that is very important. But what was so helpful for me with nonviolent communication is like, what are my own needs? Why do I care what this person thinks?
Right.
What am I trying to do? So I think that's all worth considering, and investigate and see how a more nonviolent communication approach could be helpful.
Before I heard you and Wes talk about Marshall Rosenberg's nonviolent communication, I was very aggressive in my podcast. And the next podcast I did after I heard about nonviolent communication, I apologized to everybody that I had spoken to about my beliefs and ideas about government and stuff. So I gave an apology out, and I tried to change my ways to focus on people's needs as well. And it's helped me in my marriage too, because whenever I get heated with my wife on a certain issue, I'll think like, oh, hold on, I'm not thinking about her needs. So now I'll be like, you know what, baby, I have a need for this, and I think you have a need for this. So how can we work this out better?
I think it's something that is very important for people to try and embrace in their personal face-to-face interactions with people in real life. I will say that, you know, I've received plenty of emails, or at least a handful of emails in the time that I've been doing School Sucks podcast, where people say you're a jerk, you're incredibly pompous and arrogant, and that's not how I would talk to a person in real life. But my show, and you know, it's unfortunately, I guess it's kind of unfortunate that that's the kind of entertainment that just has a mass appeal of being caustic and confrontational, and maybe a lot of the times humor is something that needs to come at somebody else's expense. But that is, for better or for worse, part of the style and presentation of the show for entertainment value. Right. And I wrote back to that person. I might have even talked about this in a podcast before. That's not how I would start with somebody in real life, you know? I mean, the only time that I would really take a similar tone that I've used on the show in the past with somebody in real life is if the conversation was going nowhere and they were being combative and sort of derisive with me, and there were people watching this interaction who could learn something meaningful from this argument by kind of putting the other person's viewpoint on display and pointing out its flaws. That's a time in real life where I would be comfortable with a more confrontational type of approach, but it's not my default position, and it should be no one's default position. But I've realized that nonviolent communication is not a language that I'm always going to be able to speak on the podcast, but I think it's a language that I need to be speaking in my own internal dialogue and need to be practicing in real life with real relationships.
Right. I agree. Like, I'm a manager at work, and yesterday a lady came in and she was very upset because she wasn't getting the service that she thought she was supposed to get, and it was because one of my employees made a mistake. Now, during this interaction, she's cursing at me, yelling, and one of my other supervisors comes over and starts addressing her. And I'm just quietly waiting and letting the lady voice her opinion. And finally, my other supervisor leaves, and I handle the situation appropriately. And the lady finally gets service, and she cries and she tells me, thank you. And you know what? I was like, you know what? I that's why I remained quiet. I was like, I know that you're not cursing at me because you're mad at me. You're mad at the situation because you haven't been serviced. You haven't got your needs met. And, you know, she went off, and then the lady that was the supervisor that came over, she was like, Rodney, you know what? I just want to thank you for the way you handled that situation. You know, I was getting upset. I was like, I know you were getting upset, and I'm glad you walked off. But I was like, I know this lady had a need that needed to be fulfilled, and I just wanted to make sure she got her need fulfilled. So it was a good day.
It's something that I've had a challenge with lately, too, where I've realized that the way that we're treated as children and the way that we are treated in school, I think that that's translating to the adult worlds in several areas beyond just our relationship with government. And this is something that I've been thinking about and talking about on my show recently, is that people seem to be happy with substandard products and with crappy customer service. Yes. That they'll just tolerate it. And I kind of like taking this stand, like, I'm not going to tolerate it, you know. Mm-hmm. But for example, this is a silly example, happened recently. I went to Dunkin' Donuts, and where are you? You got Dunkin' Donuts where you are?
Yeah, right next door.
Where are you?
I'm in Chicago.
Oh, all right. So I get a coffee from Dunkin' Donuts, and it tastes like hot water. Mm-hmm. So initially, you know, the what comes up emotionally for me, which I don't really believe that you can control these emotions right when they come into your head, right? So you're not going to have total operational control over everything that is your mind. But the first emotion is these bastards, right? And then like the Twisted Sister song starts playing in my head as I turn around to go back to Dunkin' Donuts and give them some And right then is when I have to stop and say, totally inappropriate way of thinking and dealing about with this situation. Yes, it's not like my crusade against people accepting inferior customer service and products is going to be settled with one 17-year-old at Dunkin' Donuts. So, I think it is a process, and being able to achieve that kind of serenity is something that that comes from being able to, in that moment, after there is one of these activating events that brings up all of these beliefs, whether they're irrational or not, and that leads to that reaction, that even if you can't control the activating event, and even if all these beliefs rush into your conscious mind, there is a point that before you act on them in a way that for so many of us so often is not serving our needs or certainly serving anyone else's, we can stop and say, all right, let's do an analysis of how rational my thinking is right now. And that kind of inner dialogue is something that I've really, really tried to work on, because it's something that in the past I have not been very good at all. So,
Okay. And that's the reason why I really do what I do, why I started the podcast, is because I believe, like you, that it started from parenting, how we choose to interact with other individuals in the world. Because if we treat our kids, like I have kids,
mm-hmm.
and ever since I've listened to you and Wes and nonviolent communication and Dana Martin and her unschooling movement, I've made a change in the way I've parented. Like when I first started off, I used to spank my kids. In the African American community, that was big. Like if you didn't spank your kids, something was wrong with you. And that's what I actually believed. I didn't believe it was violence on little humans. I thought it was, that's how you parent, because that's how I was parented. And if you don't parent this way, then something is wrong with you, especially if you're African American. But now I see that it's violence. And it's been hard to get my wife to see that, but now she's starting to see it. And well, not the spanking part. We stopped that a while ago. But now the thing about our kids making more choices for themselves, it was hard for her to see that, you know, they can make choices. I was like, they're not making adult choices. They're making a decision on what clothes they're going to put on, not if they're going to sign an adjustable rate mortgage or a fixed rate mortgage. I was like, these are kid decisions that they can make, and we don't need to be forcing them to do things they don't want to do. And I think that when we force, then they learn to accept that force from other people and then enact that force on people they think is below them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I remember being in a relationship with a girl a few years back, and it was probably the closest that I came to the idea that we might get married someday. And we were talking about child raising just one night, and the topic of spanking came up. And it was a real turning point in our relationship, because you know, I was talking about my attitudes, and she's like, no, I would spank kids. It's fine. It's just something that after being together for a year and a half, it had never even come up, because like we'd never even talked about, you know, the prospect of having children one day. And when I tried to really get into that subject with her, it was like, well, I was spanked and I'm fine. Well, I was spanked and I'm fine. So it was really like there was this emotional barrier that I wasn't going to be able to penetrate in that conversation. And I don't really recall if I ever tried again, but the relationship, that was one aspect of it, but the relationship ended shortly after, and we never got married and we never had kids, so it kind of became moot. But what did it feel like for you when you, having been raised where you were spanked, to come to the conclusion that this is not an okay way to treat people? Was that seems like it would be something that's like really challenging, right?
No, not the spanking part, because it was something that was actually violent, and we all, my wife thinks very logically, so that helped out a lot for her to see that spanking was violent, because this was way before we got into, you know, logic and reasoning and nonviolent communication and the libertarian movement and stuff. It was easy for us to see that spanking was wrong. But the hard part was going from letting our kids make their own decisions to us forcing them with punishments and bribery and rewards. That was the hardest, because that's more prevalent in our society, and it doesn't seem to have a violent it doesn't seem to be as violent as spanking. So it was hard mentally for us to get through that.
What I mean is, like, the implications for yourself when you have to look at the way that you were raised.
I see what you're asking me now. Yes, initially I was like, me and my wife talked about it, I thought it was all good. I was like, this must be done. When I looked at other kids that were not spanked, I thought something was wrong with them. I was like, mm-hmm. How could this be so? They need to learn. They need to be trained. They need to know consequences. That's what I was thinking.
Now, I just remember, like, from my own experience, when I went and I talked to a therapist when I was in my early 20s, and, you know, he kept asking me about my childhood. Uh-huh. And I'm like, buddy, you know, it's it's 1998 here. I got problems now, you know, like, what are we talking about 1982 for? And, you know, he would ask me to recount these childhood experiences, and I would tell these stories about my parents, and he would say, are you your parents' lawyer? And I'm like, I don't get it. And he's like, well, you just defend them no matter what they did. You defend them. And when I started to get these insights about the fact that my childhood was far from perfect, and, you know, it's not like my parents were bad people or they solely deserve the blame for any of the troubles that I've had in my life, because I think that's kind of a form of victimization.
Right.
There was this moment like, oh, crap, now this is something that I'm going to have to address. You know, this is something that I'm going to have to look at in my life today, while I still have these relationships with these people. And that was tricky. And I think that's something that a lot of people, one of the reasons why we have this transference, at least from what I've learned from, Wes obviously has been very influential on me in this respect, but, you know, the authors like Nathaniel Brandon, there is this transference where it's so much easier just to treat your kids the way you were treated than to really do an exploration of what was wrong with the way I was treated.
Right. I agree. Yeah. And even when me and my wife first had these conversations, she said the same thing. When she finally apologized to me, she said that, I'm sorry, I wasn't angry at you. I was angry because I was forced to think about the way I was treating my child in the wrong way.
Mm.
And that hurt my ego. That's what she told me.
Yeah. I certainly understand that. And that's, you know, and I can't understand it fully because I'm not a parent, but I can imagine the challenge, like, trying to broach these subjects with my brothers who are both parents is very, and they want to do a good job, and they want to do a better job than our parents did with us. I think that's a normal thing for healthy people to think, like, you know, I mean, even I talked about this on a podcast recently. My father, as troubled as he was because of a lot of his own experiences as a child with his parents, I think and he might have even pointed this out to me and my brothers a few times to say, you know, I want to be better than my mother was to me. Mm-hmm. Growing up. I mean, he didn't have a father, but he, you know, my mother did all these things, and it left this longing for, you know, me to do a better job as a parent than she was able to do, which wasn't a feat by any stretch of the imagination. But because he never really addressed what was imprinted on him through that experience, a lot of that trauma wound up being, you know, passed through anyway. So I've thought about how to address some of these subjects with my brothers. But then there's this extra trick, which I think it's really commendable that you guys were able to have such a drastic transformation, because it's not just about, like, well, I have to look at how I was parented and what that means for the future of my relationship with my parents, whether they're still in the picture or not, and just my relationship with them in thought even. But now I'm already in the process of raising kids, and I have to look at what I've already done. So I think that's like something that so many people just want to dismiss and say, oh, this is like new age crap and I turned out fine and that's it. Yeah. So
I agree. That seems to be everybody's answer to government and especially schooling and parenting. They say, well, I went through public school and I'm fine. I went through spankings during parenting and I'm fine. But I'm like, that's the reason why probably you treat other people the way you do. The reason why you want to curse somebody or hit someone when they conflict with your values or ideas of how something should be done is because that's how you were treated when you were growing up. And that's why I want to treat my kids differently. And that's what I used with my wife. All I did was use examples of what our kids would say. Our kids would say, well, mommy, does that mean you don't love me? And I would use that. I was like, do you remember when our child said, do you love me, mama, since you hit me? Or do you love me, mama, because you punished me? And that stuck with her. And she could see where I was coming from because she needed real world experience.
Yeah, and that conditional affection is something that I think is really magnified when somebody is very young, when they need that acceptance and they need that affection because it's protection, it's safety. And when it's withheld, it has a very negative impact, I think. And that could be as simple as time out, you know?
And that's what we're working on now. I mean, it's a work in progress, but we're trying.
Yeah. But I think that most people that I encounter, I mean, I've always tried to have a real positive attitude about ordinary people, from my own observations, but also kind of working towards this general conclusion that we aren't a bunch of wild animals that are stopped from ripping each other's jugulars out by the fact that there's a government.
Right.
That it's in people's rational self-interest to be cooperative and to treat other people with dignity and respect the way they would want to be treated. And we aren't these vicious beasts that are just being constrained by a few tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of laws that our towns and counties and states and federal governments make for us. But while in the real world, I see people who are friendly and polite I don't see a tremendous amount of animosity. I mean, I'm in New Hampshire and I know we're in very different places, but people hold the doors, people let each other go in traffic, they wave, they smile. And I think that one of the things that's never talked about is the suffering and silence that is so prevalent for so many people because of these experiences, whether it be school or childhood. And I know I've been there myself. So I think that, yeah, we can see a lot of people being treated really poorly in the world historically and right up to the present day. And, that's just one problem. That's just the most outward manifestation. And a lot of that has to do with what we started talking about originally, which is, collectivism turns into nationalism, turns into cultural or group identity. The other idea that other groups are inferior. All of that is made possible by collectivism, which is so related to everything else we've talked about because it is the sacrificing of individual identity, right, which a lot of childhood experience asks us to do with a lot of school experience, culture, politics. Give up who you are for the privilege of being part of this group, whether that group is a family or a political party or a nation as a whole. And it's something that has just proven to be time and time again not just detrimental to the individual, but dangerous to that group that is so treasured as a whole.
And to your point, I don't know if you follow. Do you follow basketball much?
Not too much.
But you know the game, right?
Here's my observation. And my mother's significant other used to play for the Celtics. Uh-huh. So we do a lot of basketball talk.
Okay.
And New England is a big sports area, right? Because, the Red Sox, the Patriots, and the Celtics, and apparently there's a hockey team, but nobody really cares about that.
I don't know if you remember, it was a time more recently where American basketball couldn't beat the international basketball teams in the Olympics
with their all-star crews, right?
Right, right.
Well, yeah.
What I was going to talk about is collectivism is in sport, in American sports, because in American basketball, if you're tall, then you have to play like a center. In international basketball, it doesn't matter what size you are. Whatever skills that you happen to have will determine how you play. And I think that really hurt American basketball in the Olympics and why they were losing. That's why when they started finally winning the gold again in the Olympics, it was with people that could play multiple positions and wasn't just pigeonholed and sacrificed because of their size in basketball. So that's one example that I use of collectivism, because in American basketball, that's what they do. If you're tall, you must play down in the post as a center.
That's an interesting observation. I've never thought of it that way before. My observations about the NBA, I think we remember, I don't know if it was around the early 90s when they sent this team over, and it was like Jordan and Magic Johnson and Isaiah Thomas, and it was just like Globetrotters, watching the Globetrotters play the Generals all over the world. I mean, they were beating them by like 150 points in some games. And it seems like even 20 years ago, the NBA was different. And it became more of this talent show. And I think this had a lot to do with, you know, I want to be on SportsCenter. I want to be on Top Plays. And it seemed like the team aspect of basketball is actually what was diminished. And I mean, I can watch football. I can watch basketball. I used to play hockey. I used to play baseball. I like sports, but it seemed like most team sports were a group of guys here, a group of guys there. You take some kind of ball that's representative, I guess, of a flag, and you try to get it by the other guys to some kind of place that is behind them. And baseball was different because it was the time most clearly where an individual had a chance to do something on their own.
And that's what I was going to say about football. My ideas on football, the reason it's hard for me to watch football now is because in football, you have to sacrifice yourself for the group. No matter what, every position, you must sacrifice yourself. It's never for the glory of yourself. And even in the post-game interviews, nobody can be authentic and talk about what they did. They must sacrifice their own views for what they believe everybody else wants to hear. And that's what I don't like about sports now. It's so political and so unauthentic because they must sacrifice their own individuality for what they believe everybody else wants them to say.
Mm-hmm. And there is a time, there is a time when, you know, cooperation and working with other people in a voluntary way is important. And I think that was one of the reasons why basketball suffered, was because the idea that as a team sport was diminished. And it just became more of this, like, when I have the ball, this is an individual talent show starring me.
Yep.
And the difference was in baseball, there was a time when there was a time for cooperation. There was a time when you have to work for other people. Like, if the ball is hit to you and you're playing shortstop, you got to throw it to the first baseman who's got to be standing on the bag to get the guy out. But when you're up at bat, I know this sounds like the speech that Al Capone gave in The Untouchables, but there's a chance for, what does he say? There's a chance for individual achievement. Nobody can help you. You're on your own, and you might bat runners in or get bunted along if you're on base, but when you're standing there with that bat, it's just you. All eyes are on you, and you have to achieve by yourself. So baseball is this game that is unique from all other sports except cricket, and I don't know which one came first, but where even though it's acknowledged that cooperation is part of what is necessary, there is also an opportunity to do something as an individual, which I think is important.
Right, and you never have to sacrifice yourself really in baseball. Even when you sacrifice in baseball, you're helping. You're helping yourself and your teammates.
Yeah, yeah. And somebody was talking to me, like, you know, there's the big Red Sox versus Yankees thing in New England, which has a lot of politics style animosity attached to it for a long time, especially when the Red Sox and the Yankees were closely competitive. And I was talking to somebody who was a Yankees fan, And they were talking about why the Yankees are better than the Red Sox is because George Steinbrenner makes them all get haircuts. They don't put their names on the back of their away uniforms, as teams often do. It's just their number. And it's not about being an individual. It's about being part of a team. And, you know, they all have to, their uniforms all have to be worn the same way. They can't do this new Manny Ramirez thing of having your pants baggy that go down to your cleats. everyone has to look exactly the same. And, I said, they should have jackboots on. Why not put jackboots on them? That would be even better. That would, let's find ways to strip, make them wear masks, you know? People are more fierce when they can conceal their identity. So let's go all the way. And I thought I really objected to that. I was like, that's the beauty of baseball that the Yankees and George Steinbrenner are missing, because it is a game where the individual matters.
Yep.
And I think that that's an important lesson that so many other sports fail to teach.
It's because I play basketball at Purdue University and a little bit professionally, and it's never about the individual. And what's so funny to me is so hypocritical, because it becomes about the individual, the coach, because he gets to show up everybody. He gets to punish. He gets to reward. He gets to act a fool during the game when the ref makes a bad call. But if a player gets emotional, they must be punished. And if a player does good, he still must be punished, because he must know that he's not bigger than the team.
Who was the coach at Purdue?
When I played at Purdue, it was Gene Cady. So it was Gene Cady at Purdue, and it was Bobby Knight at IU. I was by Bobby Knight, too.
Wait, you played for Bobby Knight?
No. I was recruited by him, but I ended up going to his rival, Purdue.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and like whenever we had games, Coach Cady and Bob Knight, they never shook hands, and they were never on the floor at the same time before the game.
Why? They had like a long-standing...
some kind of rivalry. I don't know why they did it like that.
Yeah.
They were never out there at the same time until the game actually started.
And for those people who will listen to this and don't know, I mean, Bobby Knight is probably one of the most famous college basketball coaches in history, really for his, I mean, he had a good record as a coach, but also really for his temperament and the way he drove the players and threw chairs. And that's the perfect example of somebody who could think they could get away with anything,
right,
but would be extra harsh on his players if they did the same thing.
Right. And thanks to technology, people were able to see the violence that he enacted on players, the physical violence. Of course, there was mental violence with all coaches back in the day. But they actually got to hear and see the physical violence Bobby Knight enacted on players. And I was able to see the mental violence that coaches did through Gene Cady. He was very mentally abusive. Especially, I always tell the story about my senior year. After my senior year, it was four seniors. And after the season was over, we had one of the worst seasons he had ever experienced as a coach. So he had a meeting with us, and he told us, I feel like you guys really did not help us this year, especially me. You didn't help me. We had the worst season ever. So since you didn't help us, I'm not going to help you. I'm not going to help you get any NBA tryouts. I'm not going to help you get overseas. The most I'll do for you four seniors is give you a number to a sports agent. And that was the end of the meeting, and one of the last times I ever talked to him. And I just thought that was so inappropriate for somebody that recruits you, comes to your house, and tells you they're going to be some type of father figure that cares for you and will look out for you for those 4 years and beyond. And I thought that was irresponsible and inappropriate for him to say to all four of us.
Yeah, it seems like the dynamics of that relationship and the power disparity would be incredibly great when especially a lot of the people who might be recruited to play college basketball don't have that kind of figure so often in their lives, right?
Right. Yeah, I agree. I was lucky that I had a father in my life.
Yeah. And I think the other whole interesting thing about high school to college sports is this is a whole other aspect of school, in places where, like down south, where football is taken so seriously, and you almost have this celebrity status in high school as a football player. And I'm sure it's true with basketball in a lot of places, is that at this still a pretty formative time in people's lives, they're coming to this belief that their value is dependent on their skill as a basketball player, their value as a human being, or their skill as a football player. And, you know, we've seen these so many times, just the behavior of some of these NBA and NFL and even MLB players when, you know, the pressure of ordinary, actual, not sports fantasy life become too much, and they've just never been equipped to handle those kinds of pressures, and there's rape, there's murder, there's violence. Yeah, it seems to be a real epidemic that starts with the idea in high school for so many that your value as a human being will be determined by your skill at this sport.
That's how I thought. I thought my identity was tied to how well I played basketball. And to your point, as athletes, it goes to the same thing we talk about government, because when you're an athlete, everything is taken care of by other people. For example, when I went from high school to college, I didn't have to do anything. I didn't have to register for classes. I didn't have to go see my advisor. Everything was done for me. So when I was interacting with my wife in college, I didn't understand what she was going through. You know, she had to do everything on her own. I had no clue what she was going through, because everything was taken care of for me. So once college was over, she was more prepared for the real world than me, because I'm looking for the next person to tell me what to do next.
Yeah. Now, when you say everything was taken care of for you, you're meaning like right down to academics?
Yeah. Like, I didn't have to. All I did was tell them, you know, tell the advisor what I wanted to study. And then she scheduled my classes for me. Practice was scheduled around my schedule. Like, I didn't actually have to schedule it around my schedule. It was done for me. Food time to eat was done for me. We had something called training table where the school provides meals for you. All you have to do is show up after practice. Like, everything was scheduled for me. It was nothing I actually had to do for myself.
Mm-hmm. And what about the actual academics?
Training, after practice, we had mandatory study table. So after practice was over, I went to study table, and then I went to class whenever, you know, class was scheduled. I didn't have anybody doing my homework. Is that what you mean? Did I have people doing homework and tests for me?
I was always curious about that. I saw this movie. Remember the movie with Nick Nolte and Shaq?
Yeah, Blue Chips.
Yeah, yeah. And it seems like it's hinted at. I mean, I haven't seen that movie
but
probably.
No, it's possible, Brett, because, you know, in college, especially back in the day, nobody knew who was in those classes. Some classes didn't take attendance.
Right.
It would have been very easy for somebody to take my test for me, yeah. But I didn't do it at Purdue. I took all my tests and did all my schoolwork.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was definitely possible.
Mm. Interesting. So I'm about out of time. Is there anything else you wanted to go over real quick? I definitely want to give you a chance to plug your podcast and site and stuff for my audience. But did you have any other questions? And we can always do this again sometime if you want.
Yeah, I want to do it again. But no, that was all I wanted to cover for today. I'm Rodney Smith. My podcast is therodneysmith.podomatic.com. That's therodneysmith.podomatic.com. And I have a blog, therodneysmith.wordpress.com.
I'll make sure there's links to that in the show notes when I repost it.